I'm a helpful Southern California Honda dealer. Recently, we've been out in our blue shirts doing random acts of helpfulness, like hosting helpful pet adoptions, helping dudes pay for engagement rings, and even donating baby supplies at a neonatal hospital. And now, during the Honda Dream Garage sales event, we can help you too with a great deal on an award-winning Honda, like the Civic, the best-selling car in California. Click the dealer locator to find a dealer near you and go to SoCalHondaDealers.com to suggest a random act of helpfulness. Based on IHS Automotive, Polk, California, new total registrations for calendar year 2015.
Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio. Hi, this is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Welcome to a really great show, a really helpful show that helped me when I was prepping for it. Because, well, when I first came to LA, one of the TV stations wanted to have me on to talk about relationships. And I was all cool and calm on the phone. Yeah, no problem. See you tomorrow. But the truth is, I was terrified. My friend Debbie had to come with me so they wouldn't end up having to peel me off the ceiling, which can be messy and unpleasant. And since then, I worked really hard in getting comfortable talking on TV, and now I love being on, and I have these techniques to conquer my jitters. But I remember all too well this feeling of being so terrified in front of people and cameras that it's like a trap door would open up, and I'd lean over, and my mind would fall out, leaving me with nothing to say. I just wish that I had this book that I'm featuring in the show tonight. It's called Choke: What the Secrets of the Brain Reveal About Getting It Right When You Have To, by Dr. Sian Bailock. Dr. Bailock is an expert in understanding and fixing that sort of hell, and that's exactly what we'll be discussing tonight, so stick with us. Hello, Sian.
Hi.
Hi. So more and more as I read your book, I got the sense that we've been missing a piece in how we judge ability. We don't see ability as psychological, but it turns out it really is.
Yeah, our ability to perform at our best, whether it's in an interview or in a test or on the sports field, is not just about what we know. It's about how we think about ourselves and whether or not we can put our best foot forward when it matters most.
And you say that some people, like your friend Abby, perform well when the stakes are high, and other people fail to perform when the stakes are highest and perform actually worse than they would in general, which was a surprise to me.
Well, I think we've all had this experience before where we're getting ready for that big moment, whether it's in a job situation or at school or on the basketball court, and we've practiced our hearts out, but when all eyes are on us, when the stakes are highest, we just can't shine. And it doesn't have to be in these situations that we think of as consistently high pressure. We can fumble on our words when we ask a question in front of others or when we're introducing ourselves to someone else, or the place where I often choke is when I'm trying to parallel park in front of my spouse.
And so actually you said in this book in the beginning that this subject was kind of me search. So you've had issues in this area?
Well, people always ask me if I do me search, if I'm trying to understand why I've underperformed in the past rather than research. And I think, you know, we've all had experiences where we haven't performed at our best, the pressure's on. And so I've just been really interested in understanding why that's the case. And I recognize that these snippets of performance define a lot of our lives, not just as students, but as adults. Whether we're meeting someone new or interviewing for that job or pitching to a client, our whole life, essentially, our career path, can sometimes depend on whether we ace the moment. And so I wanted to understand how exactly we learn how to do that.
And now a lot of this has to do with our brain and our memories. I did a show with Jeremy Deans on habit, and he talked about how we have these behavioral strings in our minds, like how to cross the street stored away in our heads, because it would be really exhausting if every time you came to a street corner, you had to figure out how one crosses the street. And you say these are called procedural memories. And so talk a little bit about them.
Yeah, the idea here is that we don't always have to think consciously about every aspect of what we're doing. And our brain learns to allow us to do certain things, whether it's speaking, we don't often think about every word coming out of our mouth, or whether it's shooting that three-point shot or that five-foot putt with our buddies on the weekend. And sometimes in these stressful situations, what essentially happens is we disrupt our ability to go on autopilot. We actually start thinking too much.
And now this is important because you say that choking isn't simply poor performance, but poor performance that occurs in response to the perceived stress of a situation.
Yeah, when I think it's important to be on the same page with what we mean when we talk about this notion of choking under pressure. And I'm not just talking about normal ups and downs. I'm not talking about the poor performance that might come about when you're just learning how to do something. What I want to understand is why, when we have some knowledge and skill, when we've prepared, when we have the ability, when we've studied, when we've prepped, why in those situations, when all eyes are on us, when something is on the line, do we sometimes fail to perform our best?
And so the memories that are involved in this, because we're dealing with sometimes having to dig stuff up from our heads when we're under stress, that's why we have such trouble. That's part of the reason we choke, that we can't dig up some of, you talk about our explicit memories, you know, that our ability to reason on the spot, that sort of seems to tank when we're under a lot of stress.
Yeah, one thing we know is that essentially our frontal cortex, that very front part of our brain that allows us to do all those superhuman things we can do, like juggle numbers in our head, reason on the fly, that part of our brain that essentially separates us from even our closest primate relatives stops functioning the way it should. I talk about this as the malfunction of the prefrontal cortex. It stops working as efficiently as it could. And one of the consequences of this is that we don't have that cognitive horsepower, that ability to think and reason on the fly. Sometimes our mind goes blank. Sometimes we start paying attention to the wrong things. Essentially, we lose that sketch pad, that scratch pad, that ability to focus on what we want and get rid of what we don't.
And I've experienced this. It's horrible when there's something that you know, and it used to be I could tell somebody sitting in a coffee shop next to me this thing, and it would be smart and articulate and everything. And then if you put a TV camera on me, all of a sudden, it's like you erased my mind. And I don't have that problem so much anymore, but it was really pretty horrible. And so I really understand what the people you write about are going through, having gone through it so much myself.
Yeah, we know that when all eyes are on you, you can essentially fail to pull out that knowledge that you have. It's like you lose the hooks to fish out the information that you know is there. Psychologists have known for several decades that just putting a mirror in front of someone makes them more self-conscious, more aware of their thoughts, their behaviors, their every move. And one of the things that having eyes on you, a video camera, people watching you, or just knowing that people are going to know how you perform, what it does is essentially disrupt your ability to fish out that information.
Yeah, it's so important for me. It was very important to stop thinking about that. I had this guy, Stevenson Phillips, this coach I worked with, who said, 80% of what you say is smart and funny, and 10% is not so smart and funny, and 10% is dumb and full of shit. And he said, but if you focus on that part, that you're worried about that, then it's all going to turn that way. And so, you know, for me, it was stopping, that I had to stop thinking about myself in order to be able to perform in a way that didn't really suck.
Yeah, when you're thinking about yourself, you're using part of that precious cognitive horsepower, that limited resource that you have to actually reason and make eloquent decisions or have important thoughts. When you start thinking about what you're doing now, you have much essentially brain power to do those other things. And, you know, one interesting point related to what you just said is that oftentimes we remember and we focus on the negative things or the things we do that We don't think we're that great, but most other people don't realize it. It's called spotlighting. We have a much better memory for our own blunders than anyone else does. And once you realize that, once you realize that everyone's paying attention to themselves and not as much to you, you can focus on that 80% you do well and realize that the other 10, 20% people probably won't remember anyway.
Right. And he actually, what he helped me do was to be excited about the information. This is something we'll get into because you have these great techniques, anti-choking techniques. And so to be excited about the information, focus on that rather than focus on me. And that made all the difference for me.
Yeah, actually, you're hitting on one of the techniques I talk about to focus on the take-home point. So you're giving a speech or pitching to a client or even on an interview. You want to focus on the outcome, essentially what you want to get across. And if you focus on that, then the rest essentially often comes for free, especially if you've practiced and done your homework.
I should do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is psychologist and researcher Dr. Sian Bailock, and her book is Choke, What the Secrets of the Brain Reveal About Getting It Right When You Have To. And that's what we're talking about tonight, how not to choke under pressure when it means the most for you to succeed. So I want to get back into working memory, which you call the cognitive horsepower. And you talk about that some people can shield this, shield information better than others and keep it from disappearing under stress. Can this deteriorate with age? What causes it to be less shielded by us?
Yeah, so working memory can be thought of as one of the building blocks of IQ. It's essentially our mental scratch pad that it helps us keep whatever we're juggling in our heads in consciousness. And some people have more of it and some people have less. There's some evidence that we can train it, even through puzzles, for example, like Sudoku or practice juggling numbers in our head. There's evidence that we can get more of this working memory. But one thing that we do know for sure is that in stressful situations, we're robbed of it. And one reason we think this is the case is because when we're in stressful situations, we often worry about the situation, the consequences, the outcome, what other people will think about us. And when we're worrying, we are now using up part of this brain power that we could otherwise have to focus on what we need to do. It's as if you were running a computer with too many programs running at once. The computer slows down, it might crash, and that's essentially what we think happens. Those worries essentially rob you of that cognitive horsepower, that thinking and reasoning ability you could otherwise have to be at the top of your game.
Now, you have one, in one of the places in your book about pausing the choke, you say that in the early 1980s, a psychologist named, I think, McKee-Chee and her team, they found that one big difference between students who succeeded and those who failed was the time they spent thinking about a problem at the outset before they tried to solve it, and that jumping in at full speed can negatively affect your success. I think that's important because we always think if something's hard, I think people want to just really just jump in, take a bite of it.
Yeah, we know from lots of work in cognitive science that one quality of, say, expert performers or people who have a lot of knowledge in a field is that they don't just jump in when they have a problem, when they have a task to get done. They spend some time at the outset planning, thinking about how this problem relates to things they've done in the past. They essentially make a roadmap for how they're going to go about tackling the issue at hand, and doing that ends up saving people lots of time in the long run. It helps you make connections between previous situations and what you're doing now, and it essentially gives you some of the tools you need to think at your best.
And you say, besides taking a step back, that one of the things you can do, and a friend of yours in the Netherlands talked about this, working with cops, that training under stress is so important, but mild levels of stress.
Yeah, I think that, I talk about this in all sorts of situations, from the sports field to the workplace to the testing room in academics, is that we need to get people used to some of the pressures they're going to feel in the real do-or-die situation. It's great to ace the SAT or your speech when no one is watching, when it doesn't count, but what really matters is whether you can do it when it will count for something. And one way to get used to the high-stakes situation, to what you're going to have to encounter, is to get used to some of the pressures, some of the bodily reactions you have, whether it's sweaty hands, a beating heart. You want to get used to that before you get in the real high-stakes situation, because that way, when you're there, it's not as novel, it's not as threatening.
And now some of the things, I love how you touch on musicians and sports figures, and you talk about the brain imaging studies done on musicians, and it's very, very interesting. And you go throughout your book talking about this, how people, we think that, oh, this is the part of your brain, it's the smart part, it's the cognitive horsepower that's behind performance, but they found, it turns out, with musicians, a lot of it is this procedural memory, like, you know, that it takes to ride a bike or golf putt, to make a golf putt, that it's just something that you've sort of developed, it's ingrained, you don't think about it. Sian, are you there? Uh-oh. I think we lost Sian. Did we lose Sian? Yes. So I told her she should call back. So I'm going to tell you something out of her book because I have a lot of notes here. So a European sports psychologist, Dr. Werner Helsen, looked at whether sports stars, specifically soccer stars, are born or made. So in other words, do professional players come into the world poised for soccer greatness? And he looked at whether professional soccer players' basic visual and motor abilities are superior to recreational players, or whether elite players only surpass the recreational ones when they perform skills specific to the soccer game. And it actually turned out that they only were great at things specific to soccer. So you can really practice and train to become great. Let me just check in and see. I think he can't call her. She's on Skype, he said. Oh, sorry, I'm just Greg Skyping me about our guest who's disappeared. He's going to call her. So, but I have enough notes here so I can tell you more about her great book, which I'll do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is psychologist and researcher Dr. Sian Bailock, and her book is Choke, What the Secrets of the Brain Reveal About Getting It Right When You Have To. And that's what we're talking about tonight, how not to choke under pressure when it means the most for you to succeed. So to tell you a little bit about more about her book, because I do have all these notes here, I'll go to a little bit of some of her suggestions for how not to choke. And again, she talks about how helpful practice is, but not just practice under pressure. And the sports psychologist Pete Lindsay talks about reducing the gap between training and competition. That's really important. Let me just tell Greg, you should call her on her cell. And another thing that she talks about is exposure therapy. It's very similar to something I've talked about before on the show, the late Albert Ellis's in vivo exercises, which means in life, where he'd have somebody shy go on the subway and announce all the stops out loud so they'd see that it wasn't the end of the world to speak out in public. And this is something also that can help people in choking, to avoid choking, to do these things, to practice these things, to go out and make a fool of themselves is one of the great things she suggests, because then you see it's not really such a big deal. Even if you fall on your face, it's not the end of the world. Let me see where our guest is. Greg, I hope you're calling her on her cell phone. Okay, I'm going to go through some more of these on preventing the chokes. She talks about Sully, the pilot who landed a plane on the Hudson River. And he's an example of somebody who is very practiced. He's so practiced. He's such a pro at what he does that he was able to do it pretty much flawlessly in a crisis. And that's really important, that sort of level of practice. I mean, doing your homework really, really does make a difference. Another thing that she talks about, and I'm talking about Dr. Sian Bailock, and her book is Choke, What the Secrets of the Brain Reveal About Getting It Right When You Have To. She talks about how damaging it can be to be stopped and restarted again. There was this American skier, Julia Mancuso, in the 2010 Winter Olympics, and she had to abort her run after another skier crashed. So she started, and they said, no, stop, we can't clear her away. There was all this arguing about how they were going to bring her back up the mountain. Was it going to be a snowmobile? Was it going to be a gondola? And she was emotionally exhausted before she even started. And this is a really big problem. This thing of like going and stopping, stalling before you even begin is a big problem. But what's very interesting is people can use this technique against other teams. Talk about goalie kicks. She talks about goalie kicks in her book, Choke. And what that is, I don't know hockey so well, but she's talking about how people will take a timeout. They'll take a timeout to sort of set the other team sort of on edge. And so it makes them choke. You can cause a choke in other people. So let's see what's happening with our guest. Greg apparently is trying to reach her. Okay. I'm going to keep going through. She has wonderful, wonderful tips here. Distracting herself is another great way to prevent choking. I talked a little bit about this, and she talks about these focusing strategies. Like if you're a soccer player who is, you know, prone to choking, that you focus on the pattern on the ball, those octagons on the ball. Or if you're a doctor, you focus on the artery you're trying to repair rather than on the movement of your own fingers and hands. Very, very important. Oh, it looks like we have Sian back. Sian, are you there? Can we hear you? Sian, are you there? Hello. Oh, great. Okay. I've gone through a bunch of your anti-choke techniques, so I'll have to tell you which ones we haven't hit on yet. But your book's so great. I have 9 pages of notes here, and they're all wonderful. So I talked a little bit about Dr. Werner Helsen and looking at soccer stars and elite players, that their skills, when their skills surpass the non-elites. And so I want to get back to that, talking about the differences and how our differences are markedly affected by training and practice. And I did mention a little bit about some of your stuff from the anti-choke techniques about how important it is to reduce the gap between training and competition from Pete Lindsay. So tell us a little bit about that in your own words instead of mine.
Right. So I think I was touching on this before, but everyone from the military to athletes, even to the best people in the business world, they practice what they're going to have to do in stressful situations. I think the current president is a great example of this. He's known for giving pretty fluent speeches. And one thing that he's also known for is practicing. He practices before he's going to be in a high-stakes situation with all eyes on him. And the idea here is essentially just to close the gap between what you're going to do in the real do-or-die situation and what you experience in practice.
And now what's really fascinating, you talk about what happens when people become experts. And one of the fascinating things was how pattern recognition played a big part in the skill of chess players and others. And you say that the chess masters actually succeeded by finding meaning in the pieces, the arrangement of pieces, and that helped them remember them.
Yeah, in choke I talk a lot about what it takes to become an expert performer and what the evidence, what the science overwhelmingly says is that it's not that people come into this world born with great memories or great athletic skills or eloquent speech. Essentially, they learn how to perform well in particular situations. And a great example are chess masters. There's been numerous studies done on chess masters looking at whether or not they just have superhuman memories. Do they just remember a lot more than you or I? And that's not actually the finding. What researchers have shown is that chess masters can remember a lot more about, say, mid-game chess configurations than you or I because they learn how to recognize particular moves or particular pieces and how they might be oriented as part of a particular game. But if you mix all the pieces up and you ask a master or someone who's really great at chess to recall what they look like on the board, they're not so great. They can't find meaning anymore in something that they're not used to performing with.
And you advise people to group pieces of information together into bundles, that will help them remember it better.
Yeah, this goes back to the idea of our cognitive horsepower and that it's limited, right? This is why it's so problematic to talk on a cell phone while we're driving. We're now dividing this limited horsepower between listening to someone on the other end and being in the car. And one way to get around having this limited horsepower is to learn how to chunk information together. So instead of remembering separate pieces of information, come up with some acronym that puts it all together. If you have 5 key points you have to get across in a meeting, come up with an acronym that uses the first letter of each of the key points to make some meaningful word. That way, if you don't remember one of the key points, all you have to do is remember the word, and that'll be a hook to get that information out.
Now, you say that learning skills early seems to matter, and you talk about the prefrontal cortex developing with age, and so earlier on, other parts of the brain take over. And just explain that, but to give people a little primer on the prefrontal cortex, what that is and what that means, you know, vis-a-vis other parts of the brain.
Right. So I talk about this idea that, you know, our frontal cortex is one of the seeds of our conscious reasoning ability, and it develops with age. Actually, the front part of our brain doesn't stop developing until we're in our early 20s. And one thing researchers have shown is that kids tend to learn sports skills, languages, lots of activities differently than adults, precisely because they don't have the reliance on that frontal cortex. And what this means is that they tend to learn skills without having to think as much about every step. It helps them learn languages better. They get accents better. They learn to perform fluently without dwelling on the individual parts of what they're doing. And one idea that I suggest in the book, in CHOKE, is that we can all learn to perform more like kids, to learn like kids. It can be really beneficial.
How do we do that? Or is that not a short answer?
Well, I mean, one, there are some studies and things I talk about in the book is that simply just distracting ourselves a little bit can lead to better performance. So singing a song when we're taking that golf putt, learning a foreign language but not focusing intently on every specific instance, but instead just the whole corpus of what we're doing can actually lead to us learning more like we would when we were younger.
And now you have this fascinating chapter that less can be more. And so this sort of plays into what you're saying now that, you know, that more working memory or cognitive horsepower isn't always better. And that people who have more working memory perform better on academic tests, but they're more likely to fail under pressure.
Yeah, one of the ideas is that people who have a lot of this horsepower are really good at juggling information in their head, but when pressure robs them of this horsepower, when now they can't think in this systematic fashion, they're in trouble. And so one idea is that these stressful situations might have the most impact, and my research shows this, and I talk about this in CHOKE, have the most impact on those people who would otherwise be most geared towards success. And so the idea here is to find techniques, to find tips, and this is what I try and do in CHOKE, that we can help us all perform at our best, essentially. So we can learn when we need to turn that horsepower on and when we need to tamper it down. In certain situations, when we're trying to think outside the box or think creatively, sometimes it's better not to focus too much. Sometimes it's good to take a step back. Sometimes it's good to do another task, essentially let ourselves stop working on the problem, at least consciously, because it turns out that we can do a lot of work when we're not thinking about the explicit issues relevant to the problem at hand.
And now, something I love that you said about thinking like a kid, you have this German psychologist test from 1945 called the Dunker problem, and it's how to attach a candle to a wall using only a box of tacks, a candle, and a book of matches. And I have to say, I instantly saw this in my head by putting a tack through the wick and sticking it to the wall because you didn't say the candle had to work. But I saw that you talk about how adults fall prey to something called functional fixedness, and it's the inability to see new and unusual ways to use an object. How can people bring back more of that sense of play that kids have, where maybe a kid probably wouldn't think of the candle having to function either?
I think the idea here is that we can do things that can mimic how kids think. So whether we mildly distract ourselves when we're working on a problem, maybe taking a walk in the woods, that's been shown to be really beneficial. This idea here that we have to sometimes let that conscious attention take a break, because when we're least expecting it, that's when we come up with the right answer. And if we're beating our head against the wall, sometimes we won't find the solution. That solution requires taking a step back. I gave a talk about this once, and a computer programmer from Chicago came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I always find the problem in my code when I'm walking home from the train after work. I can be stumped all day, and it's not until I'm walking home that I figure it out. And I think that's a perfect anecdotal example of this idea that sometimes too much focus of attention can lead us down a narrow path. We can't essentially back up and think about something in a new and unusual way. And what doing taking a step back does, or working on a different problem for a while, what it does is essentially gives our brain time to reboot. It's like turning off and turning on your computer again. You can see new ways to solve a problem. The old glitches are more likely to go away than if you just focus so hard on what you're doing and you never give yourself a break.
Greg writes that Elmore Leonard gets his ideas in the shower, and I actually I write a column every week, and I edit it by taping it on my shower wall after I've finished it, because I can see things there that I can see nowhere else. All of a sudden that this word should be different changes, and it's so fascinating how that change of environment, just printing out and putting it on the wall, makes such a difference.
Yeah, it's this idea that sometimes when you have this change of environment, whether it's in the shower or taking a walk in the woods, it gives your conscious attention time to take a break. And it essentially lets you reflect on things in a way you might not normally go about it, even if you don't realize you're doing it. That's why you get these aha moments when you least expect it, why you're so good at thinking at that that response that you wanted to say to someone in an argument an hour later, but not in the heat of the moment. It's only when you take a step back that those connections sometimes are fused.
That say sometimes, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
Sometimes come together, are fused.
Oh, fused. Okay. I should do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is psychologist and researcher Dr. Sion Bylock, and her book is Choke, What the Secrets of the Brain Reveal About Getting It Right When You Have to, and it was very helpful to me as a former sometime choker. You have this great chapter on bombing the test about why we choke under pressure in the classroom. And you say that high-powered students are less likely to give an excuse for poor performance, but that maybe that's not such a good thing.
Yeah, the idea here is that some students put so much pressure on themselves that they don't know how essentially to think about the situation as anything less than a do-or-die moment. And it often tends to be those kids that perform at the top. They always attribute a success to themselves, but always a failure to themselves as well. And sometimes you need to take a step back and say, hey, maybe I performed not as well in this as I could have because I didn't get a great night's sleep, or I didn't study as hard as I needed to. If you're always attributing it to something about yourself, I'm not smart enough, for example, then essentially that leads to a lack of self-confidence in the long run.
Yeah, it's sort of a bad story that you create that way.
Exactly. I mean, sometimes you need to say to yourself, hey, this was outside of my control. The reason I performed not as well as I could have is because it wasn't essentially something that I did wrong, or there is something I could do differently in the future. The idea here is to not ascribe meaning to yourself. I'm not athletic. I'm not smart. I can't succeed in these situations. The idea is to think about what you can change in the future. And sometimes those of us who are used to performing at the top aren't so great at doing that.
And one reason it's really important to create a story that helps you manage this is that one problem with the stress is spillover, and after you finish the thing you're afraid of, that the stress doesn't just stop and go home.
Yeah, our bodies essentially don't know when we have finished the stressful situation and we're maybe in a different stressful situation, or why we've gone from home to work. And what I talk about is that because of that, if you have a fight with your spouse before you go into work, the stress of that can spill over and affect your brain power, your ability to perform at your best throughout the day. The idea here is that there can be these lingering effects of stressful situations, and these can happen over months' time. In the book I talk about, in Choke, I talk about one experiment done with students at Cornell University getting ready to take their medical boards. And what researchers did is look at the brain functioning of these students in the 2 months leading up to their exams, and they compared it with students who were matched for age, education, everything. They just weren't getting ready for this stressful situation. And what the researchers found was that just the stress of preparing for these exams was enough to lead to less than optimal brain functioning. These students were sluggish. They weren't as great as focusing their attention. There was a spillover from the stress in their life to everything they did.
It's fascinating. And they were just doing stuff, identifying the color and things like that. It wasn't like they were doing some kind of big, scary test. And it's so amazing. And you talk about how befuddled a person can get in a heated argument with their spouse. And so this ability to calm down, to pull back, seems really essential for a lot of areas.
Sure. I mean, oftentimes in pressure-filled situations, we have this experience of our emotions getting the best of us. And one thing that our frontal cortex does, this front part of our brain does, is not only help us focus our attention, but it helps keep those emotional areas of the brain in check. And in situations, our negative thoughts, our ruminations have this tendency to take over and essentially get the best of us.
And so your brain seems to recover when you aren't under the gun, but some people have chronic fears. So what happens to them?
Yeah, I mean, it can be a chronic, essentially under-the-gun situation for these individuals. One thing we know is that you do, in non-stressful situations, have some sort of recovery. So those medical students we were talking about, 2 months after they took their exams, the researchers brought them back in and scanned their brains again. And what they showed was that they looked just like the students who hadn't been under the stress. So we do have some recovery. But if you're under chronic stress, essentially the implications are is that you might not be functioning at your best.
And now this sounds silly, but it seems that maybe writing about your self-worth can help. That there's
yeah,
some research on that? Oh, go ahead.
One of the neat things that I talk about in CHOKE is that if we just have a little bit of an understanding about why we might not perform as well as we could in stressful situations, what happens in the brain and body when we're in these high-stakes situations, we can actually develop some pretty simple psychological tools that can help people perform at their best. One is to write, say, about qualities of yourself that are important to you. The idea is that if you're in a stressful situation where you're focusing on the negative, maybe why you shouldn't perform well, then recognizing positive attributes about yourself, even if they're not related to the situation you're in, can help bolster your self-confidence, and it can actually spill over to affect your performance in a positive way.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing. That and then the students that you wrote about in CHOKE who wrote about their worries before a math test, that getting that off their chest seemed to help. And that's fascinating how these writing exercises seem so helpful. I think it was that they did 15% better than the students who did nothing before the exam.
Yeah, so we've been doing a lot of work in my lab lately looking at this technique, the writing about the worries that we talk about is expressive writing. And this was first developed by a psychologist named James Pennebaker, who's at the University of Texas. And what he has shown is that journaling and writing for people who have clinical depression is a really great way to reduce ruminations. And we thought that there was something really similar about maybe the ruminations someone with a chronic depression might have and the worries that students or anyone might experience before they go into a high-stress situation. So we decided we'd try this writing technique out in a number of studies now, some in the classroom, some in the lab. We've actually asked people to spend about 10 minutes jotting down their worries before they go into these high-stakes situations. And the idea is that getting them down on paper helps people download them from mind, offload them, such that they're less likely to pop up in the moment. And it also helps you assess the situation, think about it in maybe a less stressful light. It's as if you were writing a really angry email to someone that, of course, you'd never send. Oftentimes afterwards, you feel better. Or you can see it from a different perspective. And we think that the writing can do that. And one thing that we showed was that getting students who are really anxious about writing about tests to write for just 10 minutes before an exam boosted their scores on a final exam from a B- to a B+. And that's a pretty big deal just from spending 10 minutes jotting down your thoughts and fears.
Absolutely. Now, ruminating, we've talked about this before on the show, it's dwelling on your feelings. And so I think it's just important. I got where you're coming from on this, that you're just jotting stuff down. You weren't spending, you know, writing 25 pages about it. So I would guess that you have to draw the line between getting something off your chest and dwelling on it and reinforcing whatever your trauma was.
Yeah, we give people between like 5 and 10 minutes, and we just tell them to write as openly as possible about their thoughts and feelings about the event that's about to occur. And one of the things that we show is that getting down these negative thoughts is beneficial, but those students, those people that benefit the most are the ones who get some insight about it. Maybe they realize by the end that they've studied, they're ready for this test, or it's just one test. They gain some insight into what the situation means to them, and that can be really powerful when you are faced with the demands of a stressful situation.
And in Choke, you explained that Matthew Lieberman's work at UCLA, he found that putting your feelings into words, it seems to change how the brain copes with stressful information, and it seems to dampen amygdala activity, the area of the brain for emotional processing. That's very interesting.
Yeah, in a way, we think that one benefit of writing is that it almost unhooks the phone between these emotion regions and those important frontal regions we need to focus on what we're doing. And getting the writing out essentially allows these frontal regions to hang up on these emotion-related regions, to unhook temporarily these worries from seeping in and affecting our performance.
I should do a little station ID, and I want to talk about some of the solutions you have for this sort of stress. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is Dr. Sian Bailok, and her book is Choke, What the Secrets of the Brain Reveal About Getting It Right When You Have To. So I love how you said a great thing to do is to reinterpret your bodily reactions, that you're amped up to take the test, not, oh, it sucks, I'm going to fail.
Yeah, one thing that we've shown is that lots of people, whether they're going to succeed or fail, have physiological responses to stressful situations, whether it's sweating hard, palms, a beating heart, increases in stress hormones like cortisol. But it's not so much these physiological reactions that predict whether you're going to succeed or fail. It's how you interpret them. So if you interpret your beating heart as a sign that you're going to screw up, there's a good chance you will. But instead, if you interpret that as a sign that you brought your A game to the table, that you're actually up and ready to go, the more of this arousal you have, oftentimes the better you perform. So it's essentially how you think about your bodily state that's really important for success or failure.
And I was very interested in another thing you had to say, which is organize what you know, that you should come up with meaningful ways to organize your information that you need to remember for a big test, and that that's really helpful. What do you mean by that, and how do you do it?
Right. The idea is that one of the most powerful ways to remember is to make connections between disparate pieces of information. And so rather than just trying to remember individual facts, if you can make meaning, if you can come up with a story to tell, if you can think of the take-home points, this helps you organize your knowledge so that you can fish it out at a later time. I tell my students when they're studying for exams that they shouldn't just memorize fact after fact, that they should organize what they need to know into some sort of narrative, some sort of story, because then if you're missing part of the narrative, the rest of it comes for free. The idea is to give us your brain, essentially give yourself power, little hints to help get out information when you need it most.
Well, I love that about organizing it into a story, because we can all remember the story, Little Red Riding Hood, the wolf, you know, there's an order to it. So that's fantastic. You have all this great stuff on people in sport who choke. And after Greg told me your computer crashed, I talked about Julia Mancuso, fascinating stuff. And you talk about in basketball speak that the word unconscious describes a shooter who can't seem to miss. And that seems to be a real key to high-level sports performance, to sort of just do it.
Yeah, it's always so funny to me when you get the reporters with the superstar athletes after a great game and they're asking them what they did. And these athletes really have no idea. And that's one of the qualities of success. We talk about it as flow or being in the zone. We're working at a way that's almost unconscious. And I talk and choke about work showing that these individuals often don't remember the steps of what they just did. Their brains and bodies were in tune to perform at their best, and they did so. And one of the most disastrous things that these individuals can do is start thinking about what they're doing in these sorts of situations. It's a good way to figure out how to beat your buddy on the golf course. You just tell them that was a great shot they just took, and you want to know exactly what they did with their elbow.
I love the bit where you quote Yogi Berra and you say one of your favorite Yogi Berraisms is those who can do shouldn't teach. It's how can you hit and think at the same time? See, I was looking for the note. How can you hit and think at the same time? And it turns out that once somebody's learned a skill, they'll often internalize it so much that they don't even know what the details are, like you're saying.
Yeah. And one of the, conclusions that I've looked at is this idea that people who are so well versed at what they do. It's so automatic, it's sometimes hard to teach it to someone else. And so you could imagine Michael Jordan trying to explain how he dunks the ball. He just does it, right? He can't explain to you every step of what's going on. Or I tell my students, you know, you could imagine a Nobel laureate trying to give you a lecture on physics. They'd probably be missing a lot of the things that you as a freshman need to know to figure out what's going on. So sometimes those individuals with the highest level of knowledge and skill aren't the best at telling less skilled people what they know, which is why, say, in the business world, it's so important to develop teams that have people with all different sorts of experience so they can hopefully catch the best way to provide information to others, to make sure that you have everyone on a team who can help perform at their best.
Oh, I love that, where you talk about that, the curse of expertise and the cell phone thing, where the people with only some cell phone experience were best at predicting how long it would take for complete novices, and the people who are experts, they were worse than the novices.
And even when you told these experts that the novices made mistakes, they still weren't so great. The idea is that sometimes we get so skilled at what we're doing, it's hard to figure out how someone with less knowledge will look at a problem. I think any of those of us who have teenagers and have asked them to try and explain how they use any sort of electronic device can tell you they have all this knowledge and they certainly can't communicate how we should do it.
And now you say over and over in CHOKE that these people who they focus on their tiny bits of movement and they try to control and they think about how their wrist is moving, that those are the people who kill their fluidity and who choke by doing this.
Yeah, I think in these stressful situations, one thing that occurs is that we start worrying about what's going on. And because of this, we try and control our every movement. And this happens for sure in athletic situations or when you're trying to parallel park the car with everyone watching. But it happens in all sorts of social situations when you introduce yourself to someone at a party and all of a sudden you're aware that they're watching you and you can't even get your name out. You stutter on your every word. Now, all of a sudden, this fluid mouth movement is really disrupted because you're so self-aware of what's going on.
There's actually research that shows that when guys are really attracted to a woman, that this kills their memory. And I love that the guy, there was a guy who couldn't remember. I don't know if you wrote about this or I read it in a study recently. They're merging. But that the guy couldn't even remember where he lived when a woman asked him, "Who's so hot?" It's amazing how that works.
Yeah, I mean, I think it gets to this idea that having knowledge and skill is not necessarily 100% predictor of whether you'll be able to pull it out in the moment.
Now, a fascinating thing that you write about in CHOKE is that supportive audiences, taking the person who means the most to you, isn't always the best thing, that it can lead to this heightened attention to detail that we're talking about and really mess you up.
Yeah, the idea here, you might think that, oh, it's so great to have friends and family watching you if you succeed, but of course it's that much worse to have them fall flat, to have them there when you fall flat on your face. And so you have to think about if you're going to invite your friends and family to your recital or to that big game, you have to think about whether or not you're used to having people you know in the audience, how it's going to affect you, and maybe you should have them come to a practice first.
Yeah, I like to actually call somebody, call my boyfriend, call my little sister when I'm going to be on TV, because they really know the real me, and so I can be in that mode and not be all weird and affected. So that's good. But having somebody there, then all of a sudden, for me, I do pay attention to them, and it gets me a little bit off my game.
Yeah, and it turns out you start paying attention to yourself as well. I write in CHOKE about having my mom and dad come in to watch me give a lecture at one point. You know, here I am in professor mode, and my dad is sitting in the back of the room smiling at me. It certainly makes me think about myself a little differently.
Right. And you maybe start to think he changed my diaper and all this other weird stuff. I mean, it's just that your mind goes off in a place that it shouldn't be going, you know, and so that's a really important thing that I think people don't think about. But you make the point that paying conscious attention is sometimes good and important, like if you want to change your golf swing or baseball shot, you know, that you need to actually pay attention to how your wrist is moving, just not do it in that moment that's horribly stressful and important.
Yeah, and when we're thinking about the talk we're going to give or the talking points for the meeting, we have to actually think about what we want to say. But in the moment, you know, the idea is that we want to let what we practice run off fluidly.
And now we went through a bunch of these during the computer crash, a bunch of your wonderful anti-choke techniques. Julia Mancuso and distracting yourself. I love that about talking, where you talk about how you should focus on the dimple pattern on the ball. I'd love to have you just talk a little bit about that, because I think that is such a great technique, you know, to focus on something other than the main point.
Yeah, the idea is that in sports situations, you might want to focus on the outcome, where you want the ball to land. And then, you know, your brain and body will get the ball there. Or in giving a talk, you want to focus on the take-home message. Get that message out first, get it out at the end, and everything else, as long as you practice, will fall into place.
Yeah, and you say that when you're focusing on the outcomes, using words like smooth help the brain organize the processes you need to have a good outcome rather than on these minuscule things.
Yeah, like we talk in sports a lot about keywords or mantras, and one of the things I talk about in Choke is that there's been a lot of success for professionals in all sorts of sports by having a keyword or mantra that encapsulates the entire movement. In golf, a word like smooth, it describes the entire putting stroke, and the idea then is if you're repeating that to yourself, there's less of a likelihood that you're going to get in there and start nitpicking at those details, how your stance is, how your elbow is bent, what you're doing with your wrist in that exact moment of stress.
And you talk about dealing with head-on with your fears as a way to stop choking. And I had Dr. Ofer Zur on. He's a trauma specialist, and he talks about helping people avoid PTSD by encouraging them to come up with a story that gives what happened to them some positive meaning. And you suggest doing something similar.
Yeah, there's some really great work with Olympic swimmers showing that getting them to reframe a stressful situation, to think about essentially what they did and when they choked, say, at the Olympics in non-emotional terms, and then think about what they would do differently the next time around. So maybe not that they fell apart on a world stage or in the most important race of their life, but instead they didn't get off the blocks well, and they can fix that. Just essentially thinking about what you did in those non-emotional terms and what you're going to change next time can actually change how the brain functions. It can change how ready you are for success the next time around.
Yeah, that's so fascinating, too, about brain plasticity. And that's some of what happens with practice, too, is changing our brains.
Oh, sure. You know, I think we used to think, especially once we're into adulthood, our brain didn't change. The structure, at least, was pretty permanent. But now there's lots of work suggesting that's actually not the case. Our brains can change all the time with practice. There's great work showing that cab drivers in London, those people that have to memorize all the city streets, they have a bigger area of their brain called the hippocampus that's involved in navigation than you or I. And the idea is that all that practice driving on the streets, memorizing the maps of London, changed the structure of their brain, that area of the brain that they need to navigate.
Yeah, that really speaks highly for practice. And I want to talk about the easy way out, in a way, medicating the choke. And I am all for better living through chemistry whenever the side effects don't outweigh the benefits. And I took a beta blocker at one point for my nervousness on TV, but my shrink told me that they can impair memory and maybe even tamp down your energy. Where do you stand on that? I know you're not disapproving of them, but do you agree with that?
Well, I talk a little bit about the beta blockers and other sorts of medication and choke. And I think, you know, one of the really interesting things about, say, beta blockers is that they're legal in some contexts. Say, if you're a professional musician, they're very common in the musical world as a way to calm nerves before a big audition. But if you are taking beta blockers and you've won an Olympic medal for pistol shooting, your medal will be taken away. And the research really shows that I think what the beta blockers do most is reduce essentially excessive tremor. But they don't do that much to change performance other than reduce that tremor. And I think it goes a lot back to this idea that it's really how you interpret the situation and it's how you interpret your bodily reactions. The same physiological state can have very different consequences whether you think that state's going to be helpful or not. And so my hunch is that when beta blockers are most powerful, it's most often the case because people think they're going to work rather than anything they're necessarily doing to the system.
Yeah, very interesting. I prefer your advice to go in thinking, I'm amped up to be on TV, to take the test. It seems to be a very good idea, since it just, as you're saying, it medicates the tremors. Is that sort of physical jitters?
Yeah, and it's really only for those people who, the research suggests, it's only for those who have really excessive tremors. So for most of us, it doesn't do much. And, you know, there's some really new research showing that thinking about your bodily state in terms of the fact that you've evolved to have some of these arousal symptoms, right? I mean, we have evolved to have these sweaty palms, beating hearts in stressful situations, and that's got to be a good thing, right? For some reason, we have that. And so thinking about it that way can actually be really powerful.
And that there's adrenaline, and it's a good thing. So I want to talk a little bit about choking in the business world. I should do a little station ID first. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the best brains in science. My guest tonight is psychologist and researcher Dr. Sian Bailak, and her book is Choke, What the Secrets of the Brain Reveal About Getting It Right When You Have To. And so you say that our ability to make sense of movie plots or navigate novel situations or even form first impressions of people we meet is aided by what psychologists call schemas, which are packets of knowledge that provide us with expectations that help us interpret these new activities or situations in meaningful ways.
Yeah, it all goes back to having a story. If you have a story for how to interpret a situation, you're better able to pick up on a lot of the details. And by knowing that, we can change how we deliver information. It turns out if you give the take-home message first in a pitch or a talk, people are more likely to remember the rest of the content. And the idea is that you've now given them a file, and they can put everything else that you say into that file, into the file cabinet of their minds. And without that file to begin with, they have no way to organize their information. So rather than putting the take-home point last, get it out there first and give people a file with which they can use to organize everything else you tell them.
This is actually very much like something I know about television. You're supposed to tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. And so I think that's an easy way to remember what you're talking about.
Yeah, and what psychologists have shown is that really telling them what you're going to tell them first ends up being most important for getting that memory of what you told them out later.
Very, very interesting. And you say that these can help you, these schemas can help you set a tone for an interview, doing that, telling them what you're going to tell them, giving them a positive schema for your employment potential so they'll understand that you're the right person for the job, that you set that tone right from the start.
Yeah, I think, you know, in this day and age when job interviews are so competitive, when so many people are vying for the same positions, you have to do something to set yourself apart. And if an interviewer can't remember one person from the next because they've seen so many candidates for this position, how are you going to get that edge? And just knowing a little bit about how the brain encodes information, how we remember, can do a lot to make sure that you rise to the top.
Now, I've read all this research on mimicry, and I always think it just sounds so silly. This means mirroring the interviewer's body language or another person's body language. And this sounds so silly. I always think that they'll know, but apparently this seems to, if you do it in a subtle way, this seems to make people like you better.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to do a little thought experiment or an observation on yourself. When you're around people you like, whether it's your spouse or your friends, you tend to mimic them. You sound a little bit more like them. You pick up some of their mannerisms. And it turns out that people do this with each other as a way to share empathy, to share affection. When our body is in a similar state to someone else's, we understand them better. It turns out that spouses, especially successful couples, they do this a lot. And by the end of one's life together, you often end up looking more like each other because you're always mimicking their facial expressions.
I love that. And now one other thing that you say, we're almost out of time, but I want to make sure we get this to a few couple last things. You talk about, you say, think about what to say, not what to avoid saying. Daniel Wagner at Harvard's researched this, and it seems that focusing on not doing something can actually bring it about.
Yeah, I mean, it's this idea that if I tell you not to think of a white bear, what are you going to think of first? And so what you want to do is, I mean, it goes back to these ideas about there is science behind focusing on the positive, focusing on what you want to accomplish rather than what you're going to lose or what you don't. If you walk around thinking, don't spill that red wine, there's a good chance you will. Focus on what you want to do rather than what you don't.
Thank you. This is so great. Do you have, we're really almost out of time. Do you have one final thought for people who want to avoid choking?
Yeah, I mean, there's something I really try and get home in the book, and it's this idea that we're not born chokers or people who succeed under pressure. I think the idea is that by understanding just a little bit about what happens in the brain and body under stress, we can develop and we can use pretty simple tools to perform better. And so we all, I think, have the power to put our best foot forward when it matters most. We just need to have the right toolbox to do it.
Yeah, and this is one of the things I love about your book, how it isn't magic. If you do these simple things that you advise in Choke, what the secrets of the brain reveal about getting it right when you have to, that people can perform in extraordinary ways if they just get out of their own way.
I think that's definitely true.
So thank you so much. My guest tonight has been psychologist and researcher Dr. Sian Bailak. Her book is Choke, What the Secrets of the Brain Reveal About Getting It Right When You Have To. Thank you so much. This is an incredible and very helpful show.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, I'm a helpful Southern California Honda dealer. Recently, we've been out in our blue shirts doing random acts of helpfulness, like hosting helpful pet adoptions, helping dudes pay for engagement rings, and even donating baby supplies.